Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. If the leaked draft of the Supreme Court's decision to overturn Roe v. Wade does not change, 26 states are certain or likely to ban abortion, according to the Guttmacher Institute. In several polls, 70% of the public say Roe should not be overturned, and yet many in the media are still saying abortion is the most divisive issue of our time. We touched on this on Friday, and we decided to do another show about this because it is so important to talk about how we got here. Both sides' journalism, gerrymandering, the Electoral College, voter suppression, and a lot of dark money. True North Research released a report looking at the money raised by what they call the Supreme Court Capture Network, tied to right-wing operative and conservative lawyer Leonard Leo, who has served for years at the helm of the Federalist Society and was the legal advisor to Donald Trump, who appointed three ultra-conservatives to the Supreme Court. And what they found is that these groups raised nearly $600 million to capture the courts. We also know that when extreme anti-choice measures go to voters in states like Mississippi and South Dakota, they almost always go down. With the help of gerrymandering, Republican state politicians decided to bypass the voters and pass these laws themselves. So given the structure of the system, where do we go from here? Joining us are three guests. Lisa Graves is executive director of True North Research, an investigative research watchdog group focusing on front groups, corporations, and people underwriting a reactionary agenda. Hi, Lisa. Thanks so much for joining us again.
Thank you so much for having me.
Megan Winter is a magazine writer who has covered abortion for many outlets. Megan is the author of the book, All Politics is Local, Why Progressives Must Fight for the States. Hi, Megan. Thank you so much for joining us again.
Thanks for doing this and thanks for having me.
Jody Jacobson is a writer and strategist and former editor-in-chief of Rewire News, which focuses on reproductive rights and reproductive justice. Hi, Jody. It's so great to have you back again.
Rose, it's just a pleasure. I'm so delighted to be here with you and with the other folks on this panel. Some of my favorite people.
Well, Jody, I want to start with you because we have had you on, oh my gosh, I think since I started hosting the show, maybe at least 10 years, you've been on talking about these laws that have just chipped away at abortion in so many states. And I just wonder, I mean, you called this, you said that this was the ultimate goal, and here we are. What is going through your mind right now? How are you making sense of where we are right now?
Making sense of it is hard, although, I mean, at the risk of being tagged what I'm always tagged, which is, you know, a very pessimistic person, I think that we are here because we failed early on to both recognize and also head on address the extremely authoritarian bent of the Republican Party for the past three decades. And many times the pro-choice community has been far too closely aligned with the Democratic Party, and the Democratic Party leadership, which has been and has stayed in power for the past 20 years, has failed to act. So as one example, I was still lobbying in my career in the early part of the Obama administration, and in the office of a very prominent congresswoman who was trying to introduce a bill to codify Roe, and Nancy Pelosi shot her down. That's one of the things we could have done when we had a supermajority in the Obama administration. We could have also codified voting rights, but they didn't want to face those things head on. And so we didn't take action when we had the power. And now we not only don't have the power, but we're heading into a very dark time.
What explains that, Jody? We're going to play a clip about this after we hear from our other guests. But to your point, President Obama was speaking to the Planned Parenthood Action Fund on July 17th, 2007, and said, "The first thing I do as president is sign the Freedom of Choice Act. That's the first thing I do." But when he was asked about it during his first 100 days news conference, he completely changed his tune.
So you're asking me why that happened?
Yes.
I mean, I can tell you why I think it happened. And this is what happened in my experience throughout the early 2000s when I was working on HIV and AIDS and abortion and reproductive health, both internationally and domestically, which is that the bishops, the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops, and other religious actors started to lobby against against doing any of these things. In the HIV and AIDS bill, they lobbied against effective prevention. In other areas, they lobbied against including contraception and abortion in the ACA. So one, you had Joe Biden as VP, you had Nancy Pelosi as, you know, speaker, you had very Catholic people who were brought up and very personally incapable of really grasping these issues and personally incapable of being really passionate about them, except to raise money. And the other thing is, and I'm going to be straight out, all of the groups and all of the Democratic electeds raise a ton of money off pro-choice fear. So you also have that as a factor, but really it's the inability of elected Democrats when they had the power to stand up for what they said they would stand up for and leaving us right here.
Megan, you've been writing about this for many years. Why don't, since Jody brought up Democrats, let's start with the Democrats and what they have done and have not done over the years. What really stands out for you the most?
Yeah, I think in a lot of ways, this issue, Republicans have been very proactive and have used radical imagination to think about how they were going to use abortion to not only advance an anti-abortion agenda, but also use it as a wedge issue to seize the levers of democracy, particularly on the state level. And meanwhile, much like what Jody was saying, Democrats and to a certain extent, the major pro-choice groups as well, what they've done is really defined by absence, defined by inaction, as Jody was just saying. And I think there were a few pivotal moments, one of which was 1992 when there was Planned Parenthood versus Casey, which listeners may have been hearing about in recent days, which was a decision that eroded a core component of Roe and threw a lot of the decision-making back to the states and gave states a lot of leeway to restrict abortion. And that could have been a moment when the Democratic Party, the pro-choice groups could have invested in state level advocacy and activism, and they did not. And meanwhile, there was kind of an expectation that they would minimize reproductive rights, that they wouldn't use the word abortion. It was just as Jody was describing, not the kind of proactive, unequivocal kind of movement that could have turned things around. And then ahead of 2010, which was a redistricting year, Republicans spent a huge amount of money flipping state legislatures, and Democrats have never paid attention on the state level. So I think there's a number of cultural reasons, and I think that the, and I'm curious what Lisa and Jody think about this, but I think it was a calculation to be, almost a decision to be weak on this issue or to not be forward and out front on this issue that caused a lot of what we're seeing today. There's so many kinds of failure that we don't even have time to document in this hour that have led us to where we are today. But it wasn't just one thing. It was numerous things.
Right. Well, to be specific on gerrymandering, Megan, can you just talk about how the Democrats have really failed to take this on when it was really getting steam among the Republican Party? I mean, I'm thinking about Karl Rove and the role that he played. I mean, back in the day, we had David Daley on, who wrote a book about gerrymandering. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And he said that when some Southern state politicians approached Nancy Pelosi about it, she just really didn't take them seriously.
Yeah. So I think it's important to understand just quickly for our listeners, too. One of the reasons that, you know, in recent days, you've probably seen national pundits talking about how, oh, abortion rights are popular, oh, contraception, like that's, there's no way they're going to push national bans on these things because these are so popular. Because of gerrymandering, because Republicans, and not only Republicans, but Republicans who know that they have taken control and they've won elections because, as you said in the top of the show, these dark money groups, these extreme conservative groups whose opinions and views are very far outside the mainstream. They many of these people want a straight up Christian theocracy. Because those groups are funding these movements and because they know that the activists turn out voters, the Republican Party has focused on, let me back up. The Republican Party has focused on winning these state legislative races in large part by using this abortion issue to motivate people. And because they have a lock on these governments, they are able to push their agenda in a way where it doesn't matter what popular opinion is. They have a lock on the power. I lost my train of thought. What were you, the question was?
No, that's fine. And I guess we should point out, like we did on Friday, because it bears repeating, that again, when these extreme measures go to the people, like they did mm-hmm. in Mississippi and South Dakota, they voted against them. And so the politicians said, well, we're not going to get what we want from the voters, so let's gerrymander the districts, and then exactly. we're going to pass these laws.
Right. Exactly. And meanwhile, the Democratic Party, and I heard this a lot when reporting my book, Democrats and left-leaning interest groups have just not invested the same amount of resources and attention and concern for state-level work as the Republicans have. Because, again, the Republicans, the conservative movement, the anti-abortion movement, they have created a 30-40-year plan to take power in these really strategic ways, where Democrats and progressives tend to be reactive. Like, even in this moment, we see suddenly there's a wave of attention. And they tend to be much more defensive in their approach and much more focused on federal elections than state elections, part of which is, you know, philosophical. They're less invested in federalism as an idea, but also because, frankly, I don't think the Democrats have thought as structurally and as proactively about how they're actually going to come up with ways to build power long term.
Lisa, what would you add on? We'll get to all of the dark money, but when it comes to the Democratic Party, what really stands out for you?
Well, I think, you know, it's clear that the party, Democratic Party, has for a long time had a platform that is unequivocally pro-choice, and it has also had elected officials who are not pro-choice under the big tent of the Democratic Party. You know, that Planned Parenthood versus Casey decision was about the really regressive policies that were signed into law by the governor of Pennsylvania, who was then a Democrat, and his son became a senator, and a Democratic senator. And so within both the House and the Senate, you have had members who have been of a party that is, on principle, unequivocally pro-choice, and it has had members who are not unequivocally pro-choice or who are reluctant to be, you know, strongly pro-choice. And so I think that's contributed to it. I think that, you know, what Megan has said about the focus on building state infrastructure, that certainly rings true with what I've observed and what I've heard. There was a substantial effort by Governor Dean to really invest in party infrastructure. One of my first experiences as a college kid was walking into the party offices to see if I could volunteer. The Republican Party office was down the street. I went to look in. It was organized. The phones were there. Everything was there. And down at the Democratic Party organizing for that city, it was as if the election was a surprise. They were getting the phones installed, and there was just a lack of real investment in local political parties and local political strength. And Dean's effort to really push forward, you know, a 50-state plan to invest locally in the Democratic Party was, short-lived. And the focus has tended to be, it appears, at the national level, and money going to the national party and less of that money being raised and spent on state and local elections. And that's a significant structural deficit. It's not an impossible deficit. It's a deficit of choice, in essence. And the Republican Party and its funders have invested heavily in state infrastructure. And they've done so, over many years. But they really were able to capitalize on some of those investments at pivotal moments, including in 2010. In the, you know, that midterm election year, where suddenly there was a surge of dark money available through the Citizens United decision, and it's only grown worse since then. And Charles Koch and his brother at the time, you know, were helping to build the infrastructure of the Tea Party, which was really nothing other than a rebrand of the Republican Party, which had lost some of its luster under Bush and Cheney. And they were able to seize those levers of power. And once they had those levers of power in that pivotal year, which was a census year, they were able to use that power then to impose these extraordinary gerrymander districts, as Megan pointed out. And those districts, you know, there's obviously been gerrymandering throughout U.S. history, but with the aid of computer technology, with the data that's now available, it's become, you know, increasingly sophisticated and accurate in being able to have the elected officials choose who votes for them and to create basically minority rule through breaking apart Democratic districts or chunks of Democratic voters. We see that in Wisconsin and in North Carolina in particular. But the effect of that is not just that people are basically disenfranchised, as some litigation is pursuing that legal theory, but it's also that those representatives are, as Megan and Jody, I think, have mentioned, are just less responsive to the voters because they don't have to be. They only have to be responsive to their party because they're not going to face a challenger from the other party. And so when you have Republican Party rule with these intensively, grotesquely gerrymandered districts, what you have is a minority party rule and by the most extreme within that party. And that gerrymandering that has been made possible by that dark money combined with the Supreme Court's decision to try to remove federal courts from exercising jurisdiction to set aside those hyper-partisan districts has really led to the extremism and the advance of this anti-choice, anti-woman, anti-equality flank that has taken over the Republican Party.
And another question before we move on and talk about dark money and just where we go from here about the Democrats. Jody, to the point you made earlier, I'm just reading now from the American Prospect. Democratic leadership still supporting the House's only anti-abortion Democrat. Henry Cuellar was the only Democrat to oppose codifying Roe v. Wade. He's getting leadership support in his runoff election against a progressive pro-choice candidate. So, for example, the House in September passed legislation, the Women's Health Protection Act, that does codify Roe. Every Democrat who voted supported the bill, except for Representative Henry Cuellar, who represents a district in South Texas. He's going to be in a runoff election on May 24th against Jessica Cisneros, a progressive who challenged him in 2020. And yet he is getting support from major Democrats like Nancy Pelosi. Jody, what are your comments on that?
I mean, I think this goes back, first of all, a double tap on everything both Lisa and Megan said, basically everything. I think this goes back to how you view political power, what you view it for, and whether you have a goal in mind. And I keep coming back to this movie that I watched that really affected me, which is called 14 Peaks, about a Nepali climber who decided he was going to do what nobody had ever done, which was climb the 14 highest peaks in the world in 6 months. It's normally taking people 7 or 8 years to do it. So, and he goes through everything he can to make this happen. Like nothing stands in his way that he does not seek to overcome. That's the Republican Party. They have had decades of focus on bringing us to this point. They have sort of trained their voters to think a certain way. They have, lied. They have misrepresented. They have basically brainwashed a lot of people. And they have been for a very long time, you know, sort of proto-fascist, but we never wanted to admit that. And on the other hand, you have a Democratic Party that is in some ways, as socially, if you want to put it that way, conservative as some of the Republicans, because you've got a lot of people that were brought up in the era when, you know, sex and reproduction and abortion and all those things were just so taboo and you don't talk about them. And so in as much as they do say things like, okay, you know, it's a woman's right or whatever, they never focused on actually bringing people, you know, cultivating their constituencies, you know, really fighting for those things. I mean, they haven't done that for climate change, and we're all about to be, like, you know, facing mass extinction. And so it's really comes back to, did you have a focus on what your righteous fight was? And did you fight for that righteous fight using every tool you had? Which, I'm not using the term righteous fight to describe the Republicans, but they have had a singular focus. And, you know, we're now at the point, as someone pointed out this morning, that they have, what is it, 34 state legislatures or 32, and they need 38 to do a constitutional convention, which, if they rewrite the constitution of this country, it will never be rescued. So I think that they've had the singular focus. The Democrats have not. The Democrats always have a finger in the wind. They're always afraid to do anything, you know, outside what they think is, quote unquote, the norm. I mean, look how fast they rushed to pass a bill to, quote unquote, protect the Supreme Court justices from some protesters. I mean, Susan Collins called the police on a chalk drawing yesterday. So, like, you know, but the Democrats are apologizing for that. So it's just kind of like, really, do you have a cause? Do you use everything you can have in your power to move that cause? Or do you sort of let someone else define you? And the Democratic Party has not only let the right define it, it has let the right define every single issue and sought to cater to the right instead of being an opposition force.
Well, let's play a couple clips. As we said earlier, on July 17th, 2007, President Obama was speaking to the Planned Parenthood Action Fund, and he said, "The first thing I would do as president is sign the Freedom of Choice Act. That is the first thing that I do." He was asked about it at his first 100 days news conference, and he changed his tune.
The Freedom of Choice Act is not my highest legislative priority. I believe that women should have the right to choose. But I think that the most important thing we can do to tamp down some of the anger surrounding this issue is to focus on those areas that we can agree on.
And also, a lot of people are saying the anger around this issue, when you've got 70% support, even among, obviously, Republicans and independents. There are a lot of pro-choice Republicans, that shouldn't have to be said. But given that this is often framed as, like he said, an angry issue or a divisive issue, we have to keep repeating that. We'll play another clip. On CBS's Face the Nation on Sunday, this Sunday, Speaker Nancy Pelosi was asked about California Governor Gavin Newsom's criticisms of the Democratic Party's failure to act on this issue. And this clip starts with Governor Newsom.
Where is the Democratic Party? Where's the party? Why aren't we calling this out? This is a concerted, coordinated effort. And yes, they're winning. We need to stand up. Where's the counteroffensive?
Madam Speaker, why were pro-abortion rights Democrats outmaneuvered?
I have no idea. The fact is that we have been fighting for a woman's right to choose, and that is to choose. We have been fighting against the Republicans in the Congress constantly because the fact is they're not just anti-woman's right to choose in terms of terminating a pregnancy, but in terms of access to contraception and family planning and the rest, both domestically and globally. Mm-hmm. This is a constant fight that we've had for generations, decades, I should say,
right,
in my case, in the Congress. And we had been bipartisan early on, support for a woman's right to choose, until the politics have changed. And that's what happened to the court.
Yeah.
The science hasn't changed. But the court changed, and therefore they're deciding that it will be different. I have no idea why anybody would make that statement unless they were unaware of the fight that has been going on.
Well, you have been fighting for decades on this issue, but back when Democrats held majorities in the House and the Senate, 2009, when you were Speaker, President Obama was asked about codifying Roe versus Wade and said abortion's a moral and ethical issue and, quote, not the highest legislative priority. Do you think it was a mistake for him, for other presidents, not to push harder when Democrats had the majority?
If I just may, the focus we have right now is an urgent one in order to try to improve and try to improve this, what we're calling it, fake or draft decision, whatever it is. I think that this is a waste of time. The fact is, in 2009, we really did not have a pro-choice Democratic Party.
That is Speaker Nancy Pelosi on this Sunday's CBS Face the Nation. Before we go to break, Megan, what did you make of that exchange?
I found that difficult to listen to, and I think it, you know, underscores a lot of what especially Jody was saying earlier. And I, you know, I know this is what I'm always saying, but I think it's also so much of this has happened on the state level over the past 20 or so years. And I think this is, you know, again, just underscoring what we were all saying earlier. So much of what's happened with abortion has happened there. And if Democratic leadership had listened to people working in their state parties, in the progressive interest groups that have been in state houses, the rhetoric there has been, it has not been subtle. It's been very extreme. It's been hard to miss. It's not been tethered to any reality that anyone recognizes. And I think that if national leadership had listened to people on the ground, particularly in reproductive rights and justice organizations, you know, it would be very clear that the kind of equivocations that Pelosi was just offering are not satisfactory.
And to your point, just to give out a few stats, according to the Princeton Gerrymandering Project, out of 99 state congressional districts in Tennessee, only 7 are competitive due to the way they're drawn. According to 538, just 2 of Texas's 36 House seats are from competitive districts. We could just go on, but those are just 2 examples. And we should say that in Tennessee, we'll talk about this after the break, Governor Bill Lee signed a bill recently increasing criminal penalties for anyone distributing abortion medication through telehealth or mail amid the Supreme Court leak. The bill prohibits any distribution of abortion medication except when prescribing is done in person or by a physician. In 2019, Tennessee passed a law that would automatically ban abortion if the Supreme Court overturns Roe. The measure would make it a felony for a doctor to perform an abortion, while women seeking abortions would be exempt from prosecution. Lisa, before we go to break, what stood out for you in that clip from CBS Sunday with Pelosi?
A couple things just quickly. You know, one is, it is the case that the party has had this big umbrella. But I guess the second thing is, you know, to me, the question is, what now? Because, right. I think it's important to look back. I have just no doubt about it. But it's also, what can we do now? And groups and people like Jody have been trying to raise this alarm, and Megan as well. And the fact is that some people have not been taking that seriously. And it has been coming. And now that moment is here. And so even though the Republicans have been organizing for many years to destroy these rights and to advance this sort of very patriarchal view of society, to advance almost basically a theocratic view of the law, that die is not cast. We do not have to go down that path. We're on that path, but we can choose a different path. And there are many things that I think can and must be done to turn back this regressive, reactionary move by this faction of the Supreme Court, and to hold to account these individuals who are pushing forward these extreme measures to punish women for accessing abortion and abortion care, and to try to punish people for helping women get access out of state, to try to bar women from having access to these services if they're raped or the victim's incest, or just because in their determination of their lives, this is not a pregnancy that they need or want to have at this time. And so I hope this is a galvanizing moment, even though it's a terrifying and horrifying and outrageous moment to have this faction of the court bringing this this forward to attack this core right for women's equality.
Lisa Graves is executive director of True North Research, an investigative watchdog group focusing on front groups, corporations, and people underwriting a reactionary agenda. Megan Winter is a magazine writer who has covered abortion for many outlets and is the author of All Politics is Local, Why Progressives Must Fight for the States. Jody Jacobson is a writer and strategist and former editor-in-chief of Rewire News, which focuses on reproductive justice. Coming up after a break, we will talk about where we go from from here. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Tomorrow, we will continue our discussion about the future of reproductive rights in the U.S. We'll speak with Robin Marty, Operations Director for the West Alabama Women's Center, and UC Irvine Law Professor Michelle Goodwin, who wrote a very powerful and intense New York Times op-ed called "I Was Raped by My Father, an Abortion Saved My Life." We hope you can join us tomorrow. Today, we're speaking with Lisa Graves, Executive Director of True North Research Group. Megan Winter is author of All Politics is Local, Why Progressives Must Fight for the States. Jody Jacobson is former Editor-in-Chief of Rewire News. Jody, I just, you know, this New York Times op-ed that Professor Goodman wrote, "I was raped by my father, an abortion saved my life." I just wonder what your thoughts are on how far these Republicans are willing to go. Because when John McCain ran for president, they did not want to go this far. They did not want to talk about exceptions for rape and incest. And yet here we are, no exceptions. A Politico analyzed how much time doctors will spend in jail. In Texas, they could get a life sentence. So how do you explain why they're going so far?
Well, I mean, I think Megan said it earlier. On one hand, you have a Republican Party that has worked for many decades to gerrymander themselves into sort of, impunity. They don't have to respond to anybody because they can take power at the state level. I mean, they're replacing electoral officials with party, you know, with QAnon folks. I mean, this is where we are. This is where we have allowed ourselves to come. So I have absolutely no doubt they will go this far and further. I think that it absolutely has to be a galvanizing moment. But as one of my most cherished colleagues always says, the Democratic Party has an issue of learned helplessness. And so if you don't have a party that's willing to fight back, we can galvanize many, many people, as we have, for example, around expanding the court or doing other things. And the party's not responsive because they also don't feel, for whatever reason, and I think there's many, really accountable to the people that elect them. Part of that is that they have so many apologists. And part of it is that they're insulated themselves from, you know, what's happening. And so I think the Republicans will go as far as you can think they might go and further than that. You know, let's look at places like El Salvador or, you know, other countries where women and doctors have been imprisoned. Let's look at Indiana, where a woman was imprisoned for a suspect miscarriage. It's going to happen. It's been happening in this country. And we just have not. I say, first of all, that Roe has been dead for a while for many millions of women in this country, in the 80% of counties that haven't had any abortion provider, right? And then you've got, you know, the fact that I don't even believe that talking about rape and incest exceptions is helpful. I believe that everybody should be able to get an abortion no matter. And I'm speaking as someone whose mom almost died from an illegal abortion. Mm-hmm. I think that we have failed to really center reproductive health care as the thing that everybody says it is, which is basic, primary, public health, medical evidence, personal health care. But we keep talking about exceptions, carve-outs, blah, blah, blah. It is health care. And we are going to a very bad place unless and until we not only mobilize people, but we force the Democratic Party to change how they are mobilizing in Congress.
Well, if you'd like to join us, what are your thoughts about how we got here, where we are today, and then where we are going? You can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. To your point about prosecuting women, Jody, we should point out that in The Nation, John Nichols writes that Chief prosecutors in five of Texas's largest counties have said their offices will not criminalize or prosecute personal health care decisions. In mid-April, murder charges were brought against a South Texas woman who allegedly told staff at a Starr County hospital that she miscarried after she had attempted to induce her own abortion. The local prosecutor dropped the criminal charge, which was based on a non-existent law, but the news sent shockwaves through legal circles in Texas, where draconian anti-abortion laws are already on the books. Basically, it's just banned in Texas. So let's spend a little bit of time just talking about where we need to go. Megan, as you point out in a recent piece, supporters of legal abortion must understand that raising our voices is not going to change anything unless we also push for major immediate Democratic reforms, including ending the filibuster, which is not going to happen with these Democrats. Joe Manchin already said he's not going to vote for this women's health bill. Enshrining federal voting rights, expanding the Supreme Court, and establishing fair redistricting. So let's talk more about that.
Yeah, I think this is so important. And I completely agree with what Jody was just talking about. And before I answer this, I think a lot of us across political spectrum are attached to this idea of the United States as a place of fairness where things will moderate themselves. And I think we have to let go of that idea because it is, you know, things are going to get really dark, not just on reproductive rights, but with environmental regulation, voting rights. We're going to see a gun decision this spring too. So, you know, it's time for us to really brace ourselves. And as Lisa was saying, we can't accept this as a foregone conclusion that our democracy is going to unravel. It's time to, you know, ask ourselves who we are and who we're going to be in this moment in history. So what can we do? I mean, this is something I've been thinking a lot about, and I'm really curious what Jody and Lisa think. I think in the short term, you know, there's elections this year. If Democratic governors win in certain states, they're going to be able to override the legislature's very extreme bills. You know, so let's say there's a Democratic governor in some place like Florida or Georgia, they may be able to, you know, throw out a bill criminalizing abortion, for example. So people can get involved in those kinds of races and that's something to pay attention to. There are these bigger questions of what we do, given that Democratic leadership in Congress has not been able to pass, you know, that what would have been a landmark voting bill that would have moved us closer to a fairer representation. So part of me doesn't really know what to do, and I'm curious what Lisa and Jody think on that level. But there are ways, and I understand why these things seem wonky. I get it, why this, you know, makes people's eyes glaze over. But you can look at, you know, maybe viewers aren't, or listeners aren't in California, but you can look at your state legislature and see what your state lawmaker is doing to proactively enshrine the abortion right, and also to, like Connecticut just did something very proactive. You can look and see what your state lawmaker is doing on that. There's redistricting reforms. There are groups like Sister District that are helping people. And I think there is a much larger conversation that needs to be had. And the left, progressives, Democrats, however we frame this, need to really expand our imaginations about what we are willing to advocate for and push for, because we need major reforms, major democratic reforms, or we're in trouble. So, you know, that's what I think. And there's a number of those that people have been talking about and organizations are pushing for. But I think whatever, you know, people can look into those. And I think that getting ourselves involved in those kinds of things is important. And also we have to remember that the anti-abortion movement, they stuck with it even when the news cycle changed. Mm-hmm. And that's something that progressives need to do as well.
Right. And Lisa, what about dark money? You all at True North Research have done an incredible job of following the money and then connecting the dots. And it, like we said when you were on last week, it's almost head spinning because some groups most people have heard of, but a lot of these groups, people don't even know they exist. And all these groups have raised about $600 million to capture the court. And here are some latest numbers. According to Exposed by the Center for Media and Democracy, the anti-abortion Susan B. Anthony list disclosed a press release, and it said it's going to spend about $72 million during this year's midterm elections. And so first off, let's just talk about how people should take on dark money, because as you and your colleagues cite, they are very well coordinated. And you've got people like the Kochs who say that they're socially liberal on issues around abortion and gay marriage, but because they want their tax cuts and no regulation, they're fine to sell out these issues. And so they're all on the same team, even though they have different views.
Well, I say talk is cheap when it comes to the billionaire Charles Koch, because he can say that to the cows come home. But as you note, Rose, you know, he supports, and his faction of, you know, these billionaires that he's gathered together support almost entirely anti-choice, aggressively anti-choice politicians. And so at the end of the day, they really have to be counted as anti-choice too, because that's the agenda that they're empowering. This, you know, announcement of this spending by the Susan B. Anthony List, this group that took the name of, you know, one of the women who fought for women's right to vote and have used that name in order to advance this extreme anti-abortion agenda, you know, that's a lot of money. But what it doesn't reveal is who's funding that. And we know that there are some major right wingers, super wealthy people who are really underwriting this movement, which, as you pointed out, very clearly and many times, Rose, it's not actually a popular movement. It's not a majority movement. It's a minority of people in this country who are anti-choice, who are anti-reproductive rights. And they have among them some very wealthy people like Sean Feeler, who is the hedge funder who has helped fund anti-choice politicians and anti-choice groups, and even these totally deceptive pregnancy resource centers, which are not pregnancy resource centers, but which are propaganda outlets. And so I think it's important to really tell people, you know, that, as you said, it's not actually the majority of Americans. And in fact, it's underwritten by, in many ways, a small number of super wealthy, very regressive people who have very regressive views. And as the opinion that leaked, the draft opinion that leaked indicates, they're not just going after abortion. They're going after access to contraception, access to the most basic opportunity that women and men have to prevent pregnancy. Their decision, you know, may well undermine a whole series of rights. It certainly implicates and is likely to affect people's ability to use IVF treatments in order to get pregnant through the fertilization of embryos and implantation of embryos. It is certainly going to affect increase the effects of lack of access to stem cell research. This decision by the court that appears to be coming is a radical reactionary decision, and it's being backed by judges who were installed on the court with the help of this dark money network that Leonard Leo has helped assemble with some very wealthy people, but they're not the majority. This is not a majority you know, point of view that they are espousing, and it is indeed a reactionary point of view that I think most Americans hopefully will reject at every opportunity from here until it is basically reversed, overturned, that this reactionary agenda is something that does not represent who America is and does not represent the vision of equality for all Americans. We know that gay rights is also at stake in this decision by the way that that Alito articulated it, whether it stays in the final opinion or not. It put a marker down to attack these fundamental rights to marriage equality that people have for adults to love and marry who, you know, to marry who they love. And so really modern America is at stake, and it's worth fighting for. And as Megan pointed out, it's worth fighting for whether you win or lose in this cycle or the next cycle, depending on your political party or your, you know, what party you vote for among the major parties or other parties. The reality is that these are matters of principle. Is America going to be a country that embraces equality, women's equality, the rights of gay Americans, or is it going to be a country that has fallen into a theocracy that is not embraced by the majority of Americans?
Can we spend our final minutes talking about media coverage and the role that the media have played around all of this? Again, 70% of the public say Roe should not be overturned. These extreme measures do not pass when they go to the voters in conservative states. And yet we still hear that this is the most divisive issue of our time. There was a very good profile of Leonard Leo of the Federalist Society in the Washington Post in 2019. And He told Tom Carter, a spokesman for the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom, "I'm very familiar with the media. I spend probably close to $800,000 annually on a PR team at the Federalist Society, and we generate press that has a publicity value of approximately $146 million a year." So they get op-eds in. They speak on the radio. I mean, I hear Susan B. Anthony people and other anti-choice activists on public radio spewing just misinformation and outright lies, and they're barely pushed back on this. In fact, someone from Students for Life was on MSNBC last week, and she just said she made a number of false statements with no pushback. Jody, you've been on this for many, many years. What are your thoughts about the role the media have played, and what should they do from here on out, given how much is at stake at this point?
Well, a couple things I want to say. First, I just want to just add a couple quick things to what Lisa and Megan said, if I could quickly. I just want to also raise up the attacks on trans people that are of a piece with all of this and are very grotesque in their focus and in their, you know, violation of basic human rights and bodily autonomy in ways no different than what's happening writ large with abortion rights, no matter, you know, who needs an abortion. And the other thing I want to say is that, you know, yes, this is a dire situation, but right now I work for an organization, Movement Voter Project, that is investing in building power at the grassroots across the country to take back this country. So there's a lot of work going on, and we have to do that work. As far as the media goes, it's really shameful. Journalism is supposed to be about speaking truth to power. That is the focus of journalism. It's not both sides. It's not giving, you know, not hurting the feelings of people who, you know, have fascist tendencies. It is supposed to be speaking truth to power. And unfortunately, we have had a takeover of journalism, not just far-right journalism, but of so-called mainstream journalism by corporate owners who are really invested in normalizing egregious behavior and lies. So, you know, for 20 years, I've been calling out the fact that, you know, people lie, straight out lie on the op-ed pages of the New York Times and the Washington Post, on NPR. They don't get pushback, and they're not supposed to be allowed to lie about basic facts. It's like allowing someone on NPR to say the earth is flat. And, you know, someone goes, "Oh, that's an interesting opinion. What do you think, so-and-so, get about their contention?" I mean, it's just, it is truly, you know, malpractice by the press. And the thing is that we need powerful press accountability in this country. And I'm just not sure where it's going to come from, because I see the right wing buying up, you know, all sorts of social media, all sorts of other forms of media. And I don't see a truly, truly progressive, rights-based, fact-based effort, except at the margins. And we need tremendous investment in truth-telling, speak to power media, not just small outlets, huge investment. And that's the only thing I think that's going to help turn the tide.
Megan, what would you add? We have about a minute left.
Yeah, I totally agree. I also think that the disinformation and radicalization of the GOP that the anti-abortion movement displayed over years was a canary in the coal mine about things like QAnon and all of this that we've seen. And if abortion had not been siloed as this quote unquote women's issue and had been treated, you know, taken seriously beyond people like Jody and Rewire News, you know, maybe we would have a better understanding of what's happening now. And I'm so glad you're having Rob and Marty on. And I think people should be listening to the reporting of people who have a deep understanding of the context of the medical, legal, and political realities of abortion.
Lisa, what would you add? We have about a minute.
I just agree with what Jody and Megan said. I mean, it is a much broader fight, and there's so much more at stake. And the attack on trans rights is part and parcel of this this movement. But in terms of the media, Rose, we need more shows like yours. We need more investment in having, you know, that real accountability. And this whole facade of having these op-ed writers for these major papers who are, you know, really extremists, like why are they giving them, you know, such a platform? Why are they platforming these people who are espousing such, you know, hostile positions and untruthful positions? I think that that's got to be called out every single time.
You know, the other thing really quick, Jody, I've been noticing that in some cases, for example, you'll have a host ask one of these governors from Arkansas, for example, no exceptions for rape and incest, you know, how are you going to support all of these children, these moms, these families? For example, according to Children's Defense Fund, over 151,000 Arkansas children are disproportionately poor. 14,000 unhoused children were enrolled in public schools in 2017. I mean, the media have really failed at asking these people, mostly men, a lot of women also, but when we're talking about governors, what are you going to do to support these people? And they're saying, oh, we're thinking about that. We're going to start that. We have a program in place. So, Jody, just what about that basic question? Your voting record says nothing about supporting families and supporting children.
Not only that, their voting records belie everything they say now, because they've consistently voted against, you know, expansion of childcare assistance, expansion of SNAP, expansion of any kind of social supports for families. They make it harder and harder for anyone in need to get access to a program. I mean, this is what fascism looks like. And all we need to do is look at how they treated COVID. Mm-hmm. People died. They did not care. They do not care. It's hard to accept. I realize that. But they do not care. You can't care about life and allow climate change to run amok as we are doing right now. You can't care about quote unquote life and just criminally neglect the death of 600,000 plus people from a preventable virus, you know, a preventable infection. I just think that we have to get real and stop trying to think like, oh, there must be something that they actually will do, because they will not. And they get away with lying because the press does not challenge them. And it gives them a platform for saying, yeah, we're thinking about that.
Jody Jacobson, Megan Winter, and Lisa Graves, thank you so much for joining us. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.